Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
Well, hello everyone. It's so nice to be here again after 2 years. It's wonderful to be in this building, both to be with you, but also to be in this building that represents, in a sense, two threads, very important religious / spiritual threads in my life. As you heard Koshin say, I'm married to a rabbi. I'm very much not only culturally Jewish, but religiously Jewish. And yet, without having spent many years sitting with Buddhist groups, I wouldn't have the whatever little sense of understanding I have of the world and myself. So the two have worked very well together for me. I was actually sitting in this, in effect, little country temple, lovely little space. I remember something that I've actually just started writing about. I'm working on a new book, and I was writing the preface for the book. And I wrote a little bit about the very first time that I sat a one-day retreat, which was probably 30 years ago. And Koshin had told me that you had a one-day retreat here yesterday. And I was very, very new to sitting. So, of course, you know, it was all very uncomfortable and my mind was racing. Not that racing goes away necessarily, but, and my body was tense and uncomfortable. It was actually a country temple setting. It was the Sonoma Mountain Zen Center north of San Francisco. I believe the teacher at the time had been a student of Suzuki Roshi, who was the founder of the whole lineage, San Francisco Zen Center lineage. By the way, I am not a Zen student, I need to say. I mean, I've been lucky enough to study Zen, in a sense, and thanks to the kindness of Norman Fisher and others. But I'm not a Buddhist. I have not made that commitment. It's very important that I think of myself in terms of my identity as being somebody Jewish. Anyway, so I'm sitting, you know, probably the first sit was at like 5 or 5:30 in the morning, something I had never done before, and I was very uncomfortable throughout the day. I'm sure I was twitching a lot. And then at some point in the late afternoon, suddenly everything got quiet. Probably the first time that I had ever experienced that, certainly in a sitting. And it was a day a bit like today, and suddenly I could really hear the wind and the rain. And it was so delightful just to be able to hear. And I still remember that feeling at that time, oh, this is enough. You know, it's enough at this moment to be alive and be hearing the wind and the rain. So what I want to talk about, the title I've given for this little presentation is attention an ethical issue? And you can probably guess that my answer is yes. But we could stop right there. But I think I'll say a little more, because really what I want to do is engage you in a conversation. So I want to say enough so you have a sense of where I'm coming from. A lot of my, if you like, secular work, as Koshin noted, has been around mindfulness and technology. And the book that I wrote, Mindful Tech, and the course that I teach, which I'm teaching right now at the university, encourages people to become more aware, more attentive, more mindful of what they're actually experiencing when they're online. It turns out, surprise, that if you do that, you start making discoveries about the ways you're using the technologies and sometimes unhelpful, unhealthy, and unproductive ways, and times when you're using them well. in my writing and my speaking, pretty much to this point, I've never really raised the issue of the ethical dimension per se. When I talk about using our technologies better, I talk about using them in more effective or productive and healthier ways. But still, over the years that I've been doing this teaching, the ethical almost inevitably does arise, especially with my students. So I want to read you one short quote from a student from maybe five or six years ago. And I have my students' permission to use these quotes. This is a woman who says, "What mindfulness really is to me is the ability to direct your attention where you want it to go, to have a choice. The idea that mindfulness is really a word for choosing what to pay attention to is incredibly empowering. In a world where we are surrounded by advertisements, sales pitches, the biggest, best, and brightest promises of happiness and fulfillment that money can buy, not to mention the near constant information overload of emails, status updates, tweets, photo albums, Netflix queues, RSS feeds, playing whack-a-mole with phone notifications, Being able to direct your attention and choose what to pay attention to is, I believe, an essential coping mechanism to deal with all of these new voices, all these new things that are demanding our attention. When we are mindful, we choose to pay attention to what is explicitly important to us. Being mindful begins to reveal our values, in a way wandering lost through the digital landscape can never do." It's that last sentence I want you to notice in particular. She's saying if we really pay attention when we're online, we start to notice our values. What are we literally valuing? What in our behavior, what does our behavior say about what is most explicitly or implicitly important to us? So there you have it. I mean, that then raises the question, if we start to look at what we're doing, am I in some sense being consistent with and upholding my deepest values and intentions? Now, part of the reason that I think I've decided, and in my secular as well as in my religious orientation, to bring ethics more explicitly into this, is several things that are happening in our world right now. The political situation, right? I just saw in today's New York Times before I came, the Washington Post, keeping track of these things, says that in the first year, Donald Trump has lied or bent the truth in significant ways at least 2,000 times. He's, 5 to 10 times a day. But it's as if that weren't challenging enough. It's clear that there's a segment of our society that doesn't care. And perhaps that doesn't understand that our ability to be truthful with ourselves and with other people is part of the foundation of creating healthy community. We know that we all know this, that we destroy the fabric of the community through many routes. That's why the ethical matters in every community, is because it's not just for ourselves, but it's for other people. Another reason that the ethical has become more overtly important to me is that, as we know, there is the popular mindfulness movement. And in fact, in a sense, you could say that my work is part of that, although I feel some discomfort around that. And one of the criticisms, I think the important criticisms of the mindfulness movement, is that it seems that ethics is not an explicit part of that, that it's really just about training your attention for whatever purposes. And then finally, closer to home for me as a technologist, there is beginning to be a public discussion about the way that technologies like our phones and various apps and websites are explicitly designed to hold us and even perhaps addict us, to grab our attention in potentially unhealthy ways. And there's beginning to be a real conversation in Silicon Valley about that. So for all these reasons, I'm just starting to speak about attention as an ethical issue, and I'm really glad to have a chance to ultimately to talk with you about that. So how does attention fit into an ethical framework? Well, I've already alluded to part of it. Attention is a remarkable gift that we give to other people. The very fact that you're listening to me now makes me more articulate and smarter. And I think that's genuinely true. I mean, not just a metaphor. When we listen to other people, when we care about them, part of the way that we care about them is by listening to them. But then also by listening to and being attentive to ourselves, to our own attitudes and attitudes, which is what I was alluding to with that quote a minute ago, we get to see how well we're actually doing and seeing where we're falling short. And of course, we're all falling short in different ways. So attention as a gift to other people, attention as a gift to ourselves, and then ultimately working to connect self and others. There's a book that's just come out in the last 2 years by a philosopher at the Santa Clara University, Shannon Valor, or Valor, called Technology and the Virtues, which is all about this, and it's a wonderful book. And she says, attention is not just a cognitive skill, it is a moral one as well. Knowing when to pay attention, to whom, for how long, and in what manner, and being able to do so successfully and habitually, is just as critical to cultivating a virtuous character as knowing when to be angry or when to forgive. I think that's a wonderful quote. And notice that phrase, cultivating a virtuous character. At least in the more progressive end of contemporary life, we don't use words like virtuous all that often. I think the worry is that they've been taken over by the right wing. But in fact, you know, here in Buddhism, you have precepts, and in my tradition, we have commandments and ethical positions. And I've come to really feel that a lot of what we are, every community that is trying to cultivate a fuller and more engaged form of living is trying through its precepts, its ethical positions, to cultivate a kind of virtuous way of living in the world that and that has to be habituated and practiced again and again. And obviously, all of this applies to our online behavior as well. We can observe ourselves. We can say, when am I writing, speaking, interacting in ways that is actually for the good of others? When am I getting caught in my own little turbulent patterns that are not good for me and that are not good for others? That's pretty much the overview. The last thing I want to do for the next few minutes is I want to give you a fuller example of one of the ways that I've been trying to reflect on the ethical dimension of attention. And that has to do with policies concerning the use of devices in the classroom. As it happens, I think that Koshin, you and I had a little discussion about that when we had dinner. Every school, in some sense or other today, is having to face up to, can kids have cell phones in the classroom? Can they have them at all? When is it appropriate for people to be using their laptops, their tablets? And that, of course, applies at every level of education, including at the level of university. It doesn't mean that every teacher or every school has a policy, but in some sense, without a policy, that's your policy, which is presumably that anything goes. Now, what's interesting is that I'm not aware of any attempt to frame the use of devices and apps in teaching and learning as an ethical issue. Yes, there are I mean, people are talking about distraction, and it's not doesn't make for a good learning environment, and so on. But so I want to try out with you just a couple of points that I've been trying to work out. So first, let's take the case of a student who is not paying attention in the classroom because they're on Facebook or Instagram or Skyping with somebody or whatever it is, or playing a video game. The research is clear, and I think just practically we know that this is a diminishment of that student's potential for learning, right? If you're not paying attention to what's actually going on in the classroom, it's a problem. And so there's that first attempt to say it's just on pragmatic grounds that's not smart. But suppose we were to say that there's an ethical, frame that as ethical as well. For example, suppose that we think that learning to pay attention better, to be mindful and to be present, even when, for example, there are times when we don't want to be. For example, a student may say, well, this is boring, or I've heard all this before, or whatever it is. What if we were to see the possibility that those are times when one can genuinely be training one's attention and one's mindfulness? Even if it's true that in some sense it's boring, or the student has heard it before, to say, well, no, part of what we're trying to learn how to do is to train our attention so that it's not just about my immediate concerns in the moment, how I'm feeling. So that, in fact, a student who is being encouraged to cultivate attention even when they don't want to is looking at something beyond the self. Now, I also want to be careful about not seeming to be sort of 19th century moralistic about this. You know, everybody has to fold their hands and sit stiffly. But I'm trying to think it through from a slightly different point of view. So that's one place where maybe we could potentially bring the ethical in. A second way to look at that is, and this we know to be true, is that students who are themselves distracted on their devices distract other students around them. And this is well known, and I've actually, I mean, even for undergraduates and graduate students, I have students tell me this, that somebody else playing a game in front of them makes it harder for them to pay attention. So in fact, in a very explicit way, that student, whatever is happening for them themselves, is potentially hurting, limiting the learning opportunities of a student, other students around him or her. But then there's another dimension that I have never heard people talk about, but I think it's something that we were just practicing together here, which is, you know, there's a tendency to think that attention is just a property of the individual. But I think that attention is actually, or call it mindfulness as well, is co-constructed. A group of people sitting together with the intention of being fully present are actually creating something that is bigger than the individual, or tapping into something that is bigger than the individual. You know, coming to a place like this, or walking into places of worship of all different traditions, Jewish, Buddhist, Christian, Muslim, even when a service perhaps isn't going on, maybe some of you have had this experience, you walk into that space and you can feel it. You can feel the sort of settled energy that is present in some mysterious way by the fact that people together have been using that space to go deeper and to be present. So this last point is sort of the suggestion that in a classroom setting and probably in other kinds of settings, the more that people are actually present and attending, the more that it's actually making it possible for everyone to be there, to be more present in just those ways. So that when somebody is not joining into that stream for whatever reason, it's also about an inability or a failure to help create that shared sense of focus and aliveness through which so much of learning, I think, ultimately really happens. So I've just given you three different ideas, suggestions or thoughts that I'm playing with about how, at least in classroom settings, attention may be ethical. One is for the student who's not paying attention, they're not actually having the opportunity to train in cultivating attention, even if perhaps they don't want to, which can be a kind of learning in itself. Second, an individual student is potentially disrupting the quality of presence and attention of others around. And then third, there's probably almost no sense explicitly that we're all in this together when we're in a shared learning environment, and that we can actually co-create a shared learning environment. So the last thing I want to say, and then I'm going to open it up for discussion, is that I want to end with three words that I think are crucial in this space: intention, attention, and choice. Let me remind you what the student said at the beginning. She said, "What mindfulness really is to me is the ability to direct your attention where you want it to go, to have a choice." Right? So unless we can be attentive enough to where we actually are and what's going on for us in the moment, we may be just caught in certain forms of habitual action that may not actually be so skillful. So to be able to be aware of what's going on gives us choice. And when we open up a space of choice, that also allows us to consider, what are our intentions? What are our intentions in this moment, and what are our larger intentions for how we want to live our life? And so it feels to me like that triangle, that trio of things is very intimately related to what I'm talking about. And ultimately, if we're trying to live a fuller life for others, with others, then our ethical intentions to speak well, to do no harm, you know, to be supportive of other people and so on are crucial. Anyway, that's a little bit of a developing story for me about how I'm coming to want to talk about attention as an ethical issue. So I'll, as a way to seed our discussion, I'll just offer you two broad questions. Please don't feel that you need to address either one of these, but there might be something to look at. The first question is, how in your life do you see attention as an ethical issue? With those around you, in your family, your workplace, your online life, obviously the media, whatever dimensions you want to talk about. That's one question. So how do you see this in your own life as an ethical issue? And then the second question is, if you were to take the cultivation of attention as an ethical concern, and perhaps maybe even tie it in explicitly to your own Buddhist practice, what might you do differently? And of course, I hope that there's enough space and room in our discussion for you to feel to disagree with anything I've said. So I'd be happy to hear things if you want to take things in a different direction. Anyway, thank you for being so attentive to me, for continuing to hold this very space in which I really have felt an opening to be able to speak to you. So, anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.